Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hi, welcome to episode 18 of the Silmarillion Seminar. My name is Chris Stevens for the Tolkien Professor and my fellow Silmarillionaires. This week we focus on chapter 17 entitled, Of the Coming of Men into the West, or as the group has named it, Everybody Loves Finrod. The discussion ranged over a wide variety of topics, much of it surrounding how awesome Finrod is. Apologies to Jordan. We start with a discussion of Finrod's first meeting with the men of Beor and the migration of men into Beleriand. Special focus was on the nature of death as it relates to the fate of men and each race's understanding of men's destiny. In addition, we spent some time discussing the effects of Morgoth's spy on the debate of the men of Estelad, and then we had a rather lengthy debate on the decisions and the leadership skills of Haleth. Now, I really like Haleth because she kind of spit in the eye of both Caranthir and Thingol, so that makes her all right in my book. So without further delay, let's join the discussion.
Good evening, everybody. All right, well, let's get into it. I know you guys had put up a bunch of really good questions last week and have added a couple this time. So let's see. Let's start, Laura, with, it looks like, I think... Laura, is that your question? Yeah. Let's start with the Laura, first with yours and then with Jack's that you seconded. The point that you make here, Laura, is something that I think is really central to this, and I think it's a good way to get into our discussion of what happens with men in this chapter as we can kind of contextualize it based on what we've been seeing and talking about before. So let's talk about the finding of the elves.
It seems that the elves have sort of the same relationship with men at their coming about that the Valar had with the Eldar. Finrod comes and finds them, and the men are basically blown away by him and think he is actually one of the gods. And Finrod also, something that really struck me as very similar, is that Finrod invites them to come and live with them, with the elves, basically. Similar to how the Valar invited the elves to come live with them in Aman. And so there's sort of that mentor-mentee relationship, sort of, or almost even a parental relationship, it sort of seemed to me, with the elves and the men and the Valar and the elves. And I was really interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, a really central thing. There's no question that the parallelism is really strong, and you can kind of go really far with it. You can keep doing it. You've got not only the fact that you have the one Noldor coming among the humans and talking with them in the way that Arome, as this kind of outrider, found the elves by himself, and as you say, inviting them to come and live among them. Even the parallelism of the three different kindreds crossing the mountains at differing speeds. Yeah, I mean, it's the parallels in the two situations are very clearly... They're very strong, and I think, you know, especially now, given the sort of the conspicuousness of the fact that the one who goes among the humans, the one who is in the Arome situation, is one of the Noldor, that is one of the elves who accepted the invitation and then didn't exactly think better of it, but anyway, have then left and come back. The fact, you know, sort of it puts some more pressure on that invitation, I think. And, you know, we have been thinking quite a bit about the significance of that invitation and whether the Valar did right by doing that and what have been the consequences of that choice and what might have happened had they not made that invitation and everything. And so I think that, and again, especially since it's one of the Noldor who's doing this, I think that we can't help but, nor do I think we should help, asking those questions and thinking about, is this a bad idea too? What do you guys think?
One other thing that struck me as being a little different. When the men are invited to come live with the elves, a lot of them become servants of the elves, which is not exactly what happened in Aman. In Aman, they were free to live among themselves. They weren't in that vassal type relationship, at least not overtly.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, I agree that it sort of seems the way that this chapter emphasizes the relationship between them, there is a lot more emphasis on the vassalage of the men and their being as servants. But remember also, I mean, remember the Vanyar, you know, sort of living at the feet of Manwë and Varda on Tinequitil. And I mean, it's not like that's not a good thing and everything, but there do seem to be, you know, they do seem to have kind of attached themselves as vassals to Manwë. And that, of course, as we can see, is not that's not a degradation of them, that's an elevation of them. But I think that we also have to be careful here, because this is an elevation of the Edain as well. One thing that is pretty clear, and this is a pretty clear pattern that we can see all the way along, the elves, when the elves go over and live with the Valar in Valinor, they become greater. We see that the Kalaquendi are much greater and, well, brighter and stronger than the Moraquendi, who stayed in Middle-earth the whole time. Just so, the Edain, who live among the Eldar, are going to be bigger and stronger and greater and mightier and wiser and smarter than the other men who have not come across. This is going to be one of the reasons. Now, of course, things get a little bit different with Numenor. There's a little bit more to the magnificence of the Numenoreans than just what happens with the rest of the Edain, but still, there's a difference. And of course, we'll see this reflected even in smaller ways later on, like, for instance, Merry and Pippin growing larger and wiser as a consequence to their being away with the Great Ones in the south when they come back to the Shire. But again, you know, there's this pattern. And remember, and what we can see in all of those patterns are sort of two things at once. That first, by association with the great and the mighty, we have these, you know, these sort of lesser beings to some extent, which have been made greater, which have been elevated by that. It's not only or sort of simply a promotion. It's also through service. I mean, all of them serve the greater ones with whom they live. The men as vassals, even, of course, as you said, to think of the Lord of the Rings Peril, even Merry and Pippin, of course, swear fealty and become vassals. Both of them become vassals to human lords. So, you know, I think that we have to be cautious before feeling too uncomfortable with what seems to be the subjection or the subordination of the humans, because this is also a kind of promotion, and that kind of humility and service seems almost always to be tied with promotion in Tolkien's world. And certainly the of all of the men, if you even think of the differences among the different kindreds of the men, the ones who stay most independent are the people of Haleth, and they're the ones who are going to grow least high. The ones who grow highest are the descendants of Hador up in Hithlum, the guys who are serving under Fingolfin and Fingon in the north, and they're the ones who are most, you know, we're told that they are most completely tied, most completely subjugated to the elves. They're the ones who decree that only the elven tongue will be spoken by them. So, you know, we see this, that sort of the subordination, the humility of the humans being sort of most fully linguistically expressed there. And yet they're going to be the greatest. They're going to be the greatest, highest, and most glorious of all of the Edain. And then sort of in the middle, you have Beor's descendants, of whom Beren is going to be one. So I think that we can see this kind of trend, which I think should sort of caution us against sort of being, sort of looking too quickly askance at the apparent servitude of the men. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that taking them into service is obviously a good idea on the part of the Eldar. But I think from the Edain's perspective, serving loyally and humbly does seem to be a good thing, or at least to have really good results. But what do you guys think? More on the elves' perspective there. More on this parallel between the invitation, you know, the reaction that the elves have to the men, and their invitation to come and join them, and the Valar. Does this sort of make us automatically worried about this? Are there differences that you perceive in the two situations that kind of offset the parallels? What do you guys think? Joe, go ahead.
Well, just one big difference I noticed is the men were actually traveling and, like, seeking already. They were trying to find something, and it seems like they jumped into it almost a bit more willingly. I mean, they felt as if they were kind of missing something, and they were trying to seek it, whereas the elves were kind of hanging out and singing and having a good time, and then, you know, Orome stumbled upon them more or less. So it seems like there's a difference there, and the situation seems different, too. Like, the elves are kind of at war, so at a standstill, but, I mean, recruiting someone to help you is like a good thing, so it seems like they also have more of a reason to want to bring those people into the world than the Valar.
Yeah, which of course, you know, by itself could make it sort of seem more selfish. And of course, you know, one could make a really cynical reading of that and say like, oh, well, you know, like we need some cannon fodder, so by all means, let's get some of these lesser guys to use as shock troops. But I mean, obviously, I don't think that that's how the Eldar are thinking about it. Nor is it seems that there's any shame in seeking allies in the war against Morgoth. But you're right. I mean, Joe, I think you make a really important point about the, I guess, increased mutuality of this exchange, of this interaction between the elves and the humans. And I think that we can see it in two ways. Joe, you make an excellent point. The men are searching for something, right? And when they find the land of the Eldar, at least some of them argue that they have found it, that this is what they were looking for. Now, what they were really looking for seems to be out in the west, but this seems to be as close as they can actually get. Now, it turns out that it's not, you know, a peaceful paradise without fear or danger that they find. In fact, it's arguably, you know, the worst place on the front lines of this confrontation. But at the same time, this seems to be, you know, there is a role that they can play and good that they can do there. Again, this is what the elf friends argue about that. But again, Joe, the important point there, as you say, they're seeking for something. They're not just minding their own business by the shores of Cui Vianan, and being invited out of that place, which they weren't necessarily seeking. Remember, they had to be convinced. We had to take the ambassadors back to Valinor and then bring them back and say, hey, and convince everybody, no, really, you want to leave Cui Vianan and come with us. So that is a different situation. And also the fact that there is this kind of need. I mean, the, with the two of them, with elves and men meeting, it is much more like two groups coming together rather than one stepping down from above for the other. Even though, again, the parallels do suggest that. And Laura, I agree with the language that you used before when you called it, when you compared it to a parental relationship. There does seem to be something. It's like a little bit more, it's not quite parental, but it's also a little bit more than big sibling, too. So, yeah, I mean, I think that you're, that does seem to me, that does seem to me right. Yes, yes, the elves are in loco parentis, as you say. Yeah, Dave, go ahead.
Okay, I want to offer a point counterpoint. My point in favor that I'm giving voice to Jason's point since his mic's not working is he points out that in general in Tolkien all men who are elf friends are good, and I wonder if that's true. The vice versa is true. It seems to be true that all good men are also elf friends. So certainly if we look at like sort of later Tolkien stuff and apply it backward, it seems like men associating with elves is typically good for men. My two counterpoints against would be one, the fact that I think it's Felagund sort of at one point sort of realizes that maybe men and elves shouldn't be living together, and he gives men their own lands and lets them have their own leaders and march under their own banners, and they still let, you know, the young men come and serve, but the men live separately and have their own lives. My other counterpoint is that while maybe associating with elves in general is good, certainly associating with the Noldor might be dangerous, because after all, they go out of their way to point out at the end of this chapter that all of the particular men that they enumerate get roped into the curse of the Noldor. And they get involved in great deeds, but many of them end up suffering horrible ends. So I wouldn't say it's unequivocally good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, let's see. Taking your points one at a time here, I do agree. I mean, you know, I sort of think back to some of the comments we were making when we were looking at the arrival of the Noldor, and we were looking especially at the way they interacted with the Sindar, and that it seemed to be a good thing when the two of them joined together. You know, we were sort of pointing to Turgon and his wisdom and him as sort of the positive example, with, you know, others like Thingol and the Sons of Fëanor on the other side. You know, and community, and even reaching out across barriers to form community seems to be, or not necessarily barriers, but boundaries anyway, seems to be a good thing. And I certainly do agree there is an obvious, I mean, I'm trying to think of negative examples, like people who got men who were elf friends and also bad. I mean, that doesn't seem, I mean, there are those who, it's not like, you know, all elf friends are perfect, but generally that does seem to be a pretty good thing. Laura points out that the Rohirrim weren't elf friends, which is true, and we see that they're even suspicious. You know, we know that not only Wormtongue, but even Éomer speak slightingly of Galadriel in ignorance. So it does seem to be that there are certainly there are men who are not elf friends and who are also good. Even Butterbur could be called that, for instance. Not an elf friend, but good. However, I do think... Now Laura comes up with another interesting example here, the Master of Lake Town. You know, I'm not sure I'd call the Master of Lake Town an elf friend. He's like an elf negotiator. But I'm not sure he's exactly an elf friend. He has negotiated, you know, he works in harmony with the elves. That is, I mean, they have treaties and trade agreements and stuff like that. But I'm not sure I'd call him an elf friend, at least not in the... not in the sense in which we see people like, you know, Hador and Beor being elf friends. But I mean, so I think sort of working backwards to the larger point, Dave, that you were making, that Jason was making through you, that it doesn't seem. And this, you know, in part also goes back to what Joe was saying, too, that even in some sense, the very self-interest of the invitation, well, not self-interest exactly, but, you know, there was a desire to reach out to them. The elves, you know, needed and benefited from the humans in ways that the Valar didn't exactly. But again, they're in such a different position. You can't exactly make the... they're parallel, but they're not identical, because although the elves seem to be in some sense above humans, they're not orders of magnitude above humans like the Valar are. But anyway, so I think those are definitely good points. Other thoughts on the parallels there? Joe, you had a point before that I wanted to, because I don't want to overlook the fact, which seems to me very significant, that the role of song and singing there in this first encounter. And Joe, I think you had something that you had wanted to say about that.
All right. Well, what it was is I was wondering if you could somehow draw a parallel of Felagund awakening the men to the music of the Ainur. I mean, I know Eru really made everything be, but I wonder if you can make a connection, especially with him bringing images before the men's eyes, and just kind of like how the Ainur saw everything before it really was. I mean, they saw what it could have been. And I just thought it was an interesting parallel. It wasn't exactly the same, but I just thought there was a connection that could be drawn there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, we're even recalled explicitly to it, because the making of Arda is one of the things that he sings about. And it's just worth reading a little bit here. It's the bottom of 140 to the top of 141. It's the fourth paragraph of the chapter. Fifth paragraph of the chapter. Let's see. Now men awoke and listened to Felagund as he harped and sang, and each thought he was in some fair dream, until he saw that his fellows were awake also beside him. But they did not speak or stir while Felagund still played, because of the beauty of the music and the wonder of the song. Wisdom was in the words of the elven king, and the hearts grew wiser that hearkened to him. For the things of which he sang, of the making of Arda, and the bliss of Aman beyond the shadows of the sea, came as clear visions before their eyes, and his elvish speech was interpreted in each mind according to its measure. Joe, I think you're right. I mean, I think that there are definitely parallels that we can see. We should remember, of course, the music that the Ainur played, and then the vision of the music when Eru says to them, "Behold your minstrelsy," right? And he gives them the vision and shows them, "Here's what you just sang." And so we can see kind of both of these things happening at once. And of course, it's the making of Arda and the bliss of Aman and the Valar themselves, that he's singing about. So that's definitely there now. Now, what do we do with that? Where do we go with that connection? This is certainly, on the one hand, I mean, the way that the men react to it is to name him Gnome. That is wisdom. That is, they can see this is a person who has wisdom. They don't know anything about how the world was made or anything like that. So, on the one hand, they are simply astounded at, the fact that he knows all this stuff. But obviously there's sort of more than just that. Dave, what do you think?
I was going to point something out that's sort of taking this in a slightly different direction. I just thought I wanted to connect this to, rather than previous history, later history, connect it to Lord of the Rings again. This reminds me, for some reason, the debate over whether it's good for the men to go respond to the elves' request or not reminds me of the debate between Aragorn and Boromir about Lothlórien, where Boromir says, "No man emerges from Lothlórien unscathed," and Aragorn says, "Say not unscathed, unchanged perhaps." And I just thought that was that. This reminds me of that, and it reminds me of a lot of the sort of Hobbit point of view descriptions of elves and how elves can create imagery in our minds, that their songs are more than just songs, that they're almost like sorcery, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And certainly that, thinking of Aragorn's vocabulary there, that would be one way to frame the question we were asking earlier, right? Certainly there is change. At the very least, the Edain are changed. They don't emerge from the first age unchanged. The question is, do they emerge unscathed? Now, obviously, they're going to get scathed. I mean, they're going to be damaged in the wars. But is it harmful? Are they better off? How exactly do we think about that? So that's, I think a really interesting way to think about it. And of course, the implication of what Aragorn says is that it's not damaging, that to go into Lothlórien, to go to encounter the elves, to become an elf friend, as he has done. And of course, thinking of that same moment in the Fellowship of the Ring, knowing what we come to know later on, that is, knowing what we know after we've read the appendices, Aragorn has some very personal memories here. He was very much changed by his own visit to Lothlórien in the past, because it was during a visit to Lothlórien that he and Arwen essentially became engaged. They had their first conversation in Rivendell, but it wasn't until they met in Lothlórien that, they really agreed to wait for each other and to join together. So certainly he knows how impactful it can be and how much it can change you, though obviously he doesn't look at that as a negative thing. And somebody, Joe, you mentioned in the text that the highest house of men, the House of Haldor, seems to experience the most tragedy, and that is certainly true. But that seems to all go along together with all. It seems to be a part of this overall picture in some way. Laura, you wanted to add something here?
I was just rereading that passage where Finrod is singing to them, and. I just want to read it again real quick. Wisdom was in the words of the Elven King, and the hearts grew wiser that hearkened to him. For the things of which he sang, of the making of Arda, and the bliss of Amond beyond the shadows of the sea, came as clear visions before their eyes, and his elvish speech was interpreted in each mind according to its measure. And to me it almost like a religious, like what a prophet would say, you know, I just can't think of the word, almost as if, you know, if they had had language, they could have written this down, and this could have been, you know, the early Bible for men.
Right.
It's almost
right.
like a...
It's like revelation, right?
Revelation is the word I'm trying to think of, yes, it's like revelation. So in that way, it's kind of connected to the music. I think the original music, kind of that spiritual dimension, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think that we can see, I think that is an interesting way to think about its connection back to the music as well, because of course we remember from the Ainur Indale that the Ainur were each of them sort of invested with part of the mind of Ilúvatar, and each one of them was therefore, although they were singing their own song and making their own music, they were expressing that part of the mind of Ilúvatar that was in them. So that was in its way revelatory as well, and the way in which, one of the ways in which the creation that results from the music of the Ainur is, on the one hand, their own artistic sub-creation, but also Ilúvatar's creation. That is, it is the offspring of the child, of the thoughts of Ilúvatar as well. And I think, so thinking about the music in that sense, and Felagund's music functioning that way for the men, that this is, it's only an echo. I mean, he's just singing about the making of Arda. It's not like he's singing the making of Arda. But still, I think that we can see that, you know, this is a couple steps removed, but a similar kind of species of revelation, I think. And certainly I agree, the kind of reverence that they have for it, and they recognize it right away. Notice nobody responds to this and they're like, oh, you know, what a load of hooey this is. Who is this guy? I mean, they all recognize him, and not only recognize him, but love him, as they say later on in that same paragraph. And they took him for their lord and were ever after loyal to the House of Finarfin. And I think that, you know, that again, that service that we were talking about earlier just seems to go hand in hand with it. Joe, go ahead.
All right. Well, back at the beginning and everything, didn't it say that I don't know if it was all the children of Ilúvatar or just men could act like outside of the music, kind of? I mean, did it say that men were the only ones that could do that in the beginning? Or?
Well, there was that passage where it was talking about sort of the unusual freedom of men, which you
like
are
they're
right
not
to
really.
Recall.
I know everyone has free will, but they're not really like as restricted to the music. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, it talks about their gift of freedom, yeah.
Well, yeah, just I thought that connected with how she said, you know, each of them made of it like what they would. I mean, you know, when the men were hearing it, and that reminded me of how men could kind of do their own thing more so than other people, that they weren't set so much on as straight of a path, even though everyone has free will. I don't know, that just, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. His elvish speech was interpreted in each mind according to its measure. Yeah, yeah, no, that's interesting. That's definitely a good thought there. And I'm not sure what to do here with the freedom of the men, though we can see, certainly with Hollith, who is uppity in some good ways and in some not so good ways, we can see her independence and what we were told back in the Ainur Indale, that, you know, men are sometimes a grief to Manway, and that, you know, they use this freedom, that they have this independence. But again, I think that that's kind of the other side of the coin. You know, again, to me, I put, you know, Halith sort of poised against Hador. I mean, the two of them seem to me, because they are the two. The two who, you know, whose names are going to be given. I mean, they're going to be called the people of Halith from now on. And the House of Hador Goldenhead is going to be, you know, he's going to be the name, even though they are, you know, descended from the people of Marach. It's not going to be Marach whose name is going to be kept on. It's going to be Hador who is, you know, the head of that house. And the House of Hador is going to be talked about for the rest of the Silmarillion too. So those are the really, the, you know, in my mind, kind of these two iconic leader figures among the humans, the one of which shows the kind of independent spirit, this sort of extra free will, Joe, that you reminded us of, that the humans have. They can shape their own ends, not always for the best, but they can shape them. Or they can choose of their own free will, as Hador does, to, you know, not assert that independence and instead to serve, as of course Beor and his people choose to do, as we see here in this passage. Beor certainly seems to be more on the Hador side of the equation than the Halith side of the equation. But since I've mentioned that, John, did you want to talk about Felagund and Beor? I think
I would like to bring up first of all that of all the connections we see between men and elves, you know, it appears that this, as you've pointed out in the past, seems to be almost very emblematic. You know, how symbolic it seems that Beor, as he is called, means basically vassal in his, basically, his people's tongue, which indicates at first and from the foremost that we see him in clearly the role as basically the pupil or student of Felagund. And while it is not explicitly stated, I kind of get this mental image in my head, when basically Felagund is basically singing the song, that it is Beor who heeds it first, basically being the leader of the band of those around the fire. Now, recently, I was listening to a very rare recording of The Shaping of Middle-Earth, the volume of the History of Middle-Earth series. And in the volume, I heard a passage where Fëanor first meets the orcs, and he comes, finally, to Middle-Earth, right? And he sees a campfire in the distance, and he makes for it, and he sees the orcs. He doesn't know what to make of them. And basically, he runs out there, and he screams, you know, behold, I, you know, the grandson of Finwë hath come, you know, fly before the arrows of the Noldor, you know. And, well, I mean, that's a paraphrase of the quote, of course. Now, of course, Felagund, his approach is quite humble. I mean, you know, it is not like he's going in there, you know, being the kind of guy he is. And he's not, like, you know, persecuting or basically going in there under the immediate air of command. What he's doing is he's just chilling there with his harp. And what's interesting is, you know, we've discussed, of course, with close detail, and I don't mean to sound redundant at all, about, you know, the music of Felagund. And I couldn't help but remember not only the music of the Ainur, but also later on when finally Maedhros was rescued, basically, and, you know, of course, basically, you know, the House of Felagund basically, you know, played its part in trying to ensure Maedhros escaped, though Felagund was not the chief instrument, as we, you know, of course, know. Now, returning to Beor, what we do see also here, as you've said, is an outlook among the, you know, the princes of the Edain, not yet princes at this point, accepting fully the words, or not, well, the song of Felagund and the advice of Felagund. There is, you know, we don't really get from Beor the infringement that we see, let's say, between Marach and the other bands and the companies which are basically out there trying to find the western road, to find, you know, the light in the west. And I find it very interesting. You know, it isn't, we don't see, of course, men reacting immediately in such a manner, which shows that they are completely, you know, against or in opposition to the elves. And yet there are not all these, you know, characteristics which are exactly compatible. They are considered by some of the people of Felagund as has been either previously mentioned or shall be soon, as the Unfriends. You know, they're cutting down trees, they're basically killing livestock, something which is not very elf-like, per se. And yet, Felagund, on the outset, does not take this necessarily as a bad thing. His people do, but he doesn't. And he embraces, out of all the Noldor, being the first to find, you know, mankind, them into his service, which I think, you know, we've been looking at it in multiple views. But clearly, Tolkien definitely meant this as, I think, at that point, you know, a moment of generosity. These are people who have long been on the road. And the resurrection from basically mankind being a wandering people to that of high princes, as has been compared to the elves on the long march to Aman, is basically quite prevalent because, of course, we see basically their westerly road being halted as well, which is kind of what the Sindar do, but it's not portrayed as a negative point. You know, them actually stopping and not going to Aman is just simply realistic. They will not be able to go to the Blessed Realm. I mean, that's just not their fate. Their fate is beyond the circles of the world. And of course, you know, just to give another opposite view, though, we hear, I don't mean to jump ahead at all or to ramble, but in the Children of Húrin, we see Sador, Lavadal, Popperfoot, telling Húrin, basically, as a boy, you know, the fact that this service has been taken as emblematic by Beor and his vassalship also kind of shows man reaching high, loftier than basically the station which they were originally born into. And when they're basically born into this lofty station, there's always the chance of falling. And I think that is basically just a con, but not necessarily, you know, a completely negative view beyond the fact that it is merely just a consequence of, you know, what is, you know, currently taking place as a result of Beor's decision. So Beor, I think, acts as basically the first counselor, mediator, and lord of the Edain.
Yeah, no, I think that thinking of your comments, certainly about Labadal in the Children of Húrin there. You know, that, of course, I want to be careful of because the Children of Húrin is a little bit different. But still, about the possibility of fall. And certainly, it, you know, though we don't get. One thing that I think is interesting, though, this is, in a sense, kind of jumping ahead, too. We don't, although we have all of these parallels, we don't get exactly, we don't really get a Feanor figure. I mean, Túrin is the only thing we're going to get that's sort of close to it, to a fall in that way. But we should, that we should save for, of course, the Túrin discussion. Exactly. We'll do a couple weeks on Túrin.
The thing with Túrin here, it's great foreshadowing, but we have to be, of course, cautious, you know, not to go too far. But on the other hand, we do see that the whole fact that in the beginning, Beor, his point of view and his way of addressing Felagund, you know, in the manner which he does, I think is quite unique. Because what it does show on the outset, apparently, is basically the nature of mankind. Mankind isn't basically necessarily in, you know, Tolkien's, you know, depiction as basically being as ragged as the Avadi, and yet are basically the students of basically the wandering dark elves, and they have some nobility, but their nobility is chiefly derived from the connection, as basically shown by Felagund, which is, you know, which of course appears as, you know, the first real union, first real friendship between man and elf. And, you know, I don't mean to, you know, to keep everyone waiting here, but with the death of Beor, we also see the introduction of the doom of man, or the gift of Iluvatar, which is depicted in certain terms, which, I mean, are very new and very applicable from the elven point of view, this being supposedly, you know, from Tolkien's mythology, of course, an elven document being the Silmarillion. And this is one point where Beor acts immediately, I mean, right off the bat, as not only an introduction to basically mankind, but an introduction to elvish standpoints on mankind. I mean, we saw, of course, a passage earlier. remember it was like the 3-page document, not document, it was like a chapter. It was on men after the rising of the sun. And we got some of that elvish perspective. But here, it's basically seen through the eyes of Felagund. Like, right away, this isn't told in some kind of overarching narrative where, you know, we are only quickly glancing over events from a bird's eye view. This is very much from Felagund's, or from the people of Felagund's point of view, or later on, people of his house or other elves. So I didn't mean to butt in, but, you know, just something which I noticed.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I do love both. So there are two moments that really jump out to me as giving us that kind of insight. The second one is the death of Beor, as you say, when, you know, Finrod and all the rest of the elves are like, whoa, look at that. He's like not even sad. Nobody stabbed him. He's just up and died, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you almost get this sense that he's like a little tourist attraction there. You know, like, come see the spontaneously dead guy. But at the same time, even before that...
They put up a sign. Imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, come and see the corpse. This is incredible.
Hey, come and see. Great, great. Bring your family.
But the second one, the first one, which is even more understated, I think, is when Felagund asks him, so tell me about the birth of mankind. Like, where did you guys wake up? You know, were you next to a lake too? You know, how far away was it? And Beor's like, I have no idea. You know, I mean, like, my distant ancestors who did that have been dead for a long time. You know, he says, indeed he knew
and
little.
Also, not to interrupt, but also Sador.
Later yeah.
On, I mean, I keep on going to the children of Húrin, but he does repeat that same imagery, because Húrin asks as a boy, you know, oh, well, Labadell, what about the origins of mankind? You know, is death merely something like, you know, the evil breath or, you know, some malady caused by Morgoth? And the answer that is given is, well, you know, Sador's like, I don't know. You know, it's completely beyond me, because I think what this shows is, I mean, the reason why I think mankind was introduced earlier, and not just right here, was to show many generations definitely have passed. This is, you know, the Silmarillion covers hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years of history. The whole, basically, known history of Arda, save for the Fourth Ages and ages beyond. And what's interesting is the idea that Beor is basically only the tip of the iceberg of what is probably a very long and unknown story, but he's only the beginning of another story, so it's like, you know, bookends.
Yeah. I want to go back to an earlier point, and I'd be interested here to hear from some of the rest of you too. The point that John made about Finrod, that is his character, as John said, the kind of guy he is, which is, I think, a really important thing. It is crucial, I think, that it is Finrod and not somebody else. You know, John was pointing out, you know, for instance, how things might have gone differently had it been Feanor who had come in that night. And Finrod is different. And I think Finrod is, you know, he is clearly, you know, the fortunate guy, the providential figure to arrive in this place at this time. I mean, imagine if it had been Caranthir, for crying out loud. But certainly his patience and his willingness to reach out. If you think about Finrod, one of the things that really separates Finrod, we were talking before, I alluded to our previous conversation about Turgon and the way in which Turgon establishes links, and we see him bringing about the greatest of the unions between Sindar and Noldor within his realm. But Finrod is really the boundary crosser. He's the only guy who is friends with everybody. He goes hunting with the sons of Feanor. You know, he hangs out with the sons of Feanor. He is allowed into Doriath. You know, only the children of Finarfin are allowed into Doriath. Even Fingolfin and his kids aren't allowed in. Only those who are blood kin to Thingol are permitted in. So Finrod can go into Doriath. He can hang out with the sons of Feanor. Of course, he's close to Fingon and Fingolfin as well. He's friends with the dwarves. He's had dealings with the dwarves. And remember, he's the one who gave them all of those Valinorian gems to make into the Nauglamir, the necklace of the dwarves. And now he establishes connections with the Mentu, you know, so it sort of seems like, of course, it's logical that he would be the one who would be sort of the Elvish ambassador to humankind and start this off. Anyway, I think that's really his contribution, and I love the fact that Finrod's, I don't know, sort of moniker. I mean, the thing that he's called Finrod the Beloved several times, and we see right away that the men love him. The association that he has with love, and the way the extent to which people love him, I think is really an important thing to remember. Oh, and Laura, you're totally right. Everybody loves Finrod. That is an excellent title suggestion. anyway. So I do think that it is important, and that, you know, remember that he notices right away that they're not orcs. And of course, it's hard for me to not think about Treebeard there, right? Remember, Treebeard also showed equal patience and unhastiness in diagnosing that strange visitors that he comes across are not orcs. So there's some parallel to that as well. But still, I think that, you know, Finrod, and especially, you know, with the explicit connection back to Orome, with the fact that he was hunting and everything, is pretty cool. Let's see, Jack, we had skipped over, I was just realizing that there was a question that you asked that I had wanted to get to a long time ago, and then I just kind of left it behind. And that was your question about the origin of men in the East and possible connections to Genesis?
Yeah. Okay, origins of men, shrouded in mystery. We've seen the parallels between the Elves' journey and men's journey, and you and Laura went over that, and it's all very obvious. But where it breaks down is when you go back to the origins of men. They don't have their lake of awakening, Cuvinian. They don't have that lake under the stars. And I was wondering, as I was reading this, I was trying to get into the mind of the author, was he leaving room for the story of Genesis, or the biblical account of the origins of men, the Garden of Eden, etc.? And I wonder what your thoughts on that were. And also, he even points out, I think he even lends credibility to that, is that he mentions that Morgoth actually snuck out of his keep and went over there and perhaps played the Satan role. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say basically a resounding yes to the basic question. Does it seem that Tolkien is leaving the door open for Genesis 3 to go on here? And I think definitely yes. Just to review what we know here, Beor says, a darkness lies behind us. A darkness lies behind us, and we have turned our backs upon it, and we do not desire to return thither even in thought. So there's something dark behind them. What is it? We don't know. But we know that Morgoth went there personally, as you say, maybe in serpent form, maybe not, but Morgoth went there personally to check out men in their early beginnings. And then, to me, the most intriguing sentence of all, of his dealings with men, the Eldar indeed knew nothing at that time, and learnt but little afterwards, but that a darkness lay upon the hearts of men, as the shadow of the kinslaying and the doom of Mandos lay upon the Noldor, they perceived clearly, even in the people of the elf friends whom they first knew. To corrupt or destroy whatsoever arose new and fair was ever the chief desire of Morgoth, and doubtless he had this purpose in his errand, by fear and lies to make men the foes of the Eldar. That parallel that he makes, that is the parallel that that Tolkien makes between the darkness that lay upon the hearts of men and the shadow of the kinslaying and the doom of Mandos that lay upon the Noldor, seems to me a pretty clear reference to original sin there. The curse of Mandos has been sounding like original sin to some extent, or at least similar to the idea of original sin. For a while, especially, I think, actually, the passage that we sort of discussed less than I thought we would, in retrospect, the passage at the end of the Maeglin chapter, where this is that there is something crooked in Maeglin, and that his love for Idril is sort of taken as evidence of his crookedness, and that people speculate that it was basically a result of the doom of Mandos, that it's part of the curse of the Noldor that is sort of manifesting itself in this crooked desire on his part. Anyway, so I do think that we can see some glimpses of an original sin concept. We know that Morgoth was there personally. We know there's some darkness in the past. We're not given any more information about it because, of course, from where would we get it right there? But, yeah, Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, that sentence that you read about Morgoth, that really struck me, too, that we have this question about what happened. And it made me wonder if men's tendency to be sickly and to age quickly and all that, if that sort of, I mean, I wonder if Tolkien was even thinking upon those lines, and that some of that seems to go away a little bit after they come in contact with the elves. Their lives are longer, for instance. That was just a thought that occurred to me, that perhaps some of the physical symptoms, the physical sickness that you see men subject to, maybe some of that was part of what went on then with Morgoth.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, and that we don't know for sure. All we're told about, you know, what might have happened before, you know, near the beginning of men and what the consequences of it were, you know, all we're told is just about this shadow that lies on their heart, and which seems to impact them, and impact their decisions and to manifest itself in their choices and things, just as the curse of Mandos and the doom of the after effects of the kinslaying are manifested in the choices of the Noldor. And this is going to be part of the question that is going to be raised. I mean, this is, you know, one of the things, and I think we've talked about it before, I mean, one of the fundamental kind of theological questions that Tolkien's sub-creation here has set up, that is the idea of death as the gift of Iluvatar, seems to be in contradiction to the Christian teaching that death is the consequence of sin, and that there would not have been death had there not been sin, and so therefore it's not part of the initial program, not part of the initial plan for humans by God. That's the traditional idea of the relationship between sin and death, and it's noteworthy because it seems to be one of the only theological things that's really different in Tolkien's system. This is something that Tolkien thought about more as time went on, and I think in the debate between Finrod and Andreth, again Finrod, that Christopher published in Morgoth's Ring, we can see some later thoughts of Tolkien on this, where he voices, he gives voice to a human side of this question, in the mouth of Andreth, a wise woman of the Edain, who tells Finrod, "No, you're wrong. Death was not part of the initial gift of Iluvatar to men, and this is not how men are supposed to be." So, I think that's, as I said, this is a concept. Exactly what, you know, if there is an original sin to men in his world, you know, like what is it and what are its consequences? This is something that he really was working on and thinking about throughout his life and kind of refining his approach to. Dave, go ahead.
I am remiss, and I've never read that conversation between Andreth and Finrod. Is any light shed there upon what actually happened, and how much of it is, what something Morgoth did to them versus what the men did, or what Morgoth's role was in it tonight? And Laura's yelling at me in the text for not having read this. I'm sorry, Laura. Just haven't done it yet.
It definitely is worth reading. Not exactly because I mean, to some extent, but I mean, she's still human too. So all she has from the past is she has rumors. I mean, she says more than Beor does, or you know, than we get about what Beor said here in this passage. But it's not like she knows exactly what happened. What she talks about is that, you know, when Finrod is talking with her about the mortality of humans and how, you know, they seem just to be visitors or guests here, and remember some of those names that were given for men by elves earlier on in the earlier chapter, you know, the aftercomers, the sickly, remember all that stuff. And so Finrod is talking about that, like, you know, yeah, to us, you guys look like you don't even really belong here, and this is not your home and whatever. And she is pretty emphatic in saying that's not how it always was. That was not the original conception. This is a consequence. We were not, in fact, meant to die. Anyway, I'm not gonna try to recap the whole thing. But she doesn't give detailed specifics because, again, I mean, she doesn't know. But
well, what I'm curious about is, so this must be one of those things that Tolkien either hadn't fully made his mind up about, or maybe was changing his mind about later. But I mean, it seems pretty clear from the sort of published Silmarillion stuff in a lot of his letters that this is the qualitative difference between men and elves. Maybe not the sickliness and other things, but death is a gift from Iluvatar to men, and that this is a qualitative difference, that otherwise men are pretty much just elves who die, you know, and it turns out to be that. Of course, I guess there is that one letter he has where, with the priest, where the priest says death is not a gift, it's a punishment, and Tolkien says yes, but even punishments from God are gifts, so
right.
Maybe there's room for both interpretations, but
yeah,
it seems like there's a very interesting tension going on over this.
No, I definitely think so, and this is what, in my mind, what makes that that piece, the debate between Finrod and Andreth, so sublime, is where he takes this in the end. The sort of the final place where, as both of them, in their kind of going back and forth and giving the human perspective on things and the elven perspective on things, and where they arrive to, which is not either one of those things, but both of them learning new, sort of a new perspective and coming to an understanding of how the whole system works, and both of their places, you know, both of them learning more about their own natures and their own places in the larger scheme. It's really pretty amazing. So yeah, I don't want to just kind of diverge into just summarizing that entirely. But anyway, yeah, it's I certainly think you're right, Dave, to point to a tension there. And I think that it is a really important tension, and certainly there's no removing the fact that death, certainly through the Silmarillion, death is the defining element of humans. As you say, it is the primary difference between elves and men is mortality and all of the consequences of that, because it does have consequences. It makes them look at things differently. It makes them live their lives differently. It makes their relationship to the world, their relationship to each other, their relationship to the elves, their relationship to God, all of these things are very different from those of elves because of that difference of mortality. Let's see. And I think, Dave, you had wanted to talk before about... Wait. Matt, I want to come back to a question that you... something that you had typed way back. Actually, I think last week you typed this about Felagund doing another yada, yada, yada here in his description of the bliss of Aman with the elves. Did you want to comment on that?
Sure, I'll do that. I mean, it seems to be a recurring pattern that anytime they refer back to, you know, before they came back, they never talk about the bad stuff. They only talk about, you know, it was really great over there and everything, you know, and they kind of gloss over all the bad things that's happened. And I just think that's interesting that, you know, when they relate their story that they don't seem to talk about these things.
Yeah. It makes me, you know, since yesterday on Facebook was Monty Python quotation day, I have that in my head. It makes me think of, you know, let's not bicker and argue about who killed who. They're willing to let bygones be bygones. You know, why should we dwell on the unpleasant things? Let's think about the good parts. You know, yeah, Damon is pretty awesome, really, all things considered, and the elves are really glorious. But now here, this is different. I would say that there's a pretty big difference between Felagund not him not explaining about the dark and checkered past of the Noldor to the men here, and nobody's mentioning the kinslaying to Thingol, which, you know, you can see why Thingol's kind of upset about this. Like, oh yeah, remember, you know, your own people, the ones that you were king of? Yeah, we kind of slaughtered a whole lot of them. That's pretty clear. Pretty clear why he would be offended by that or upset about that. One could argue, I guess, you know, for the men, it's not really their business, right? Do they really need to know? This is an internal affair, you know. Is this really something that they have to know? And I don't think it's necessarily covered over. I mean, I don't think that we're supposed to understand that the men never find this out. That, like, to them, the kinslaying is in fact a mystery, in the same way that it was a mystery to Thingol for a long time. And I think, you know, it's certainly the initial story. You know, what we hear from Felagund, what we hear Felagund singing to them about, seems to me an emphasis on joy and harmony and, you know, Finrod kinds of things rather than tragedy.
But it might temper their overall feeling that the elves are totally awesome and have no flaws.
Yeah, sure, I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, I guess it might not be the thing you want to put first in your recruitment speech for allies, right? Come join the Noldor who, you know, stab their friends and allies in the back and butcher anybody who gets in their way. Not an awesome recruitment strategy, I think. I certainly agree with that. Though, notice it's interesting, even when we get to the internal debates among the men, and the some men who are wanting to, some men who are skeptical and wanting to turn away, they don't bring that up. You know, they're not like, look, these elves are a piece of work. You know, they don't have their stuff together at all and can't be trusted. That's not the direction they go. I think is it because they're ignorant? Possibly, I guess, possibly. But based on what men we see men interacting with them before, you know, I don't get the impression that they're living in ignorance for, you know, it permanently anyway. Okay, let's see. Dave, I want to go back to your... you were talking, I think, about Haleth's pride before, and I think, if I remember correctly, in the text chat before, Jordan was yelling at me for criticizing a strong female character as being uppity. Totally unfair, I should say, by the way. It is not because she is a strong female character that Haleth is uppity. I say uppity only because she, like, doesn't take anything from anybody, including advice or, like, pleas from her people. Please don't make us walk through the valley of terror. We just want to live contentedly where we are, and Haleth is having none of it. But anyway, Dave, you had thoughts about Haleth's pride?
Yeah, sure. We were actually last week when we postponed this episode, we had a brief debate in the chat room on My Middle Earth about her pride, and we were sort of saying there's a general sort of feeling of, why did she not take Carinthir up on his offer? Why did she insist on going west? And that seemed like kind of a not particularly good or wise decision. Wouldn't it have been better to stay? And we were sort of just trying to figure out, is this sort of bad pride or good pride? And what were her reasons for not wanting to stay good? She's a very interesting character. So this is like only tangentially related, but I particularly love her quote that she sends back to Thingol. I'm going to read it now just because like it, because I love it.
Yeah.
So Thingol says, "All right, fine. I guess they can stay there, even though that's my land, but only as long as, you know, you guys don't let the orcs come in here." And Haleth says, "To this Haleth answered, 'Where are Haldad, my father, and Haldar, my brother? If the king of Doriath fears a friendship between Haleth and those who have devoured her kin, then the thoughts of the Eldar are strange to men.'" And I love that quote. That's like one of my favorite Silmarillion quotes ever, because she really puts him in his place. It's just kind of, you know... very, very odd suggestion, Thingol, the idea that she would tolerate the orcs after they butchered her family.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is such a wonderful comeback, because of course what she's saying is exactly right, though she's turning it back at him, right? You know, then the thoughts of the Eldar are strange to men. You've just, you know, by asking this question, by saying this to us, oh, like, make sure that you don't let the orcs in, make sure that you don't become allies with the orcs. You know, she's basically saying, look, by even saying that, you are implying that you believe that the thoughts of the Edain are strange to you. You wouldn't act that way. Why would you even suspect, why would you even entertain the idea that we would do that? If you think we would do that, then your thoughts are the strange ones, not ours. In other words, one of the things that she seems to be saying here is, look, you know, we're not as weird as you think we are. We are not as unlike you as you think we are. And Thingol clearly is really distancing himself. You know, he is like the anti-Finrod, you know, in this chapter and in other places. If Finrod is the beloved, Thingol is not. And he is certainly setting himself aside from men and looking down his nose is too gentle a way to put it. I think that Haleth's response to him is not only, as you say, extremely cool, but I think very appropriately, I think it's still very appropriately drawing attention to not only what's good about her, but what's questionable about Thingol.
Well, she seems to be the first of many men who, and she's not even a man, she's a woman, the first of many human beings in this book who put him in his place or show him to be a fool or make him eat his words. You know, Beren being like the most obvious one, but he seems to have a really bad track record with women, with human beings.
Yeah, no, it's true. He does not really... he does not really do a very good job of relating to other people and understanding other people. And even when he becomes sort of more benevolent, I guess, that is in his attitude towards men, when he comes to accept men later on, he still seems a little on the clueless side, but we'll get to that later on. Anyway, there's a sort of a spontaneous disagreement breaking out here in the text about her leadership. Let's go ahead and talk about that. If you guys want to debate with each other, you can debate with each other aloud. Is Haleth a good leader or not? What do you think?
I'm jumping in first. So Laura, and believe it or not, Laura and I were the ones debating this last week. Laura seems to read this as her being portrayed in a bad light, and I don't see that at all. Whenever I read through this chapter, my lasting impression of her is that she's awesome. She's a kick-butt leader. I mean, she makes certain questionable decisions, and maybe this says more about me than it does about the character of the book, but I read her as, you know, maybe a little foolhardy, maybe headstrong, but determined and strong and willful, and I think she's a great leader. Maybe I don't agree with all her decisions necessarily, but I think she's a great character. I don't find her portrayal to be negative at all.
Well, I don't think she's entirely negative, but I think she makes some really bad decisions. You know, I have to, if I'm going to put a moral judgment on them, I'd say the decision to move all her people westward when they don't want to, through a very perilous journey, losing quite a few of them in the process. I'd say that was a selfish decision. And I think of all the female leaders that Tolkien portrays, Galadriel and to a certain extent Eowyn, don't get portrayed in quite... I mean, I'm not saying she's portrayed in an overwhelmingly negative light, but she's portrayed as being more human, I think, than the other. She's not this idealistic goddess who does everything right.
Really? So, Eowyn? You think Eowyn's a more positive portrayal? I mean,
Well, I do think so in her leadership capacity. When she leads the people, she doesn't do anything to put them at risk, like Haleth does. So I think that's the difference there. That's the thing that I'm pulling out of that, is that Haleth was not the greatest leader.
She does endanger her people.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
fair enough.
Yeah, and just to read that passage a little bit, I think I could just, yeah, I want to sort of tie this down to the text, and you guys can go ahead again. See, she wants to go through the north of Dorioth. That land was even then not yet so evil as it after became, but it was no road for mortal men to take without aid, and Haleth only brought her people through it with hardship and loss, constraining them to go forward by the strength of her will. At last they crossed over the Brythiac, and many bitterly repented of their journey, but there was now no returning. And we're told, but then, to do justice to it in a couple more sentences, but there were many who loved the Lady Haleth, and wished to go whither she would and dwell under her rule, and these she led into the forest of Brethil between Taglin and Sirion. Thither in the evil days that followed, many of her scattered folk returned. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I just think that it's just a more realistic portrayal. I think one of the things Tolkien has been criticized for is having this portrayal of women as these unbelievably good people who never do anything wrong. Eowyn, you know, is flawed, but she's still pretty good. I think Haleth really comes the closest to being a portrait of a female leader who's not just somebody to be looked up to all the time.
Though she is clearly beyond normal people. I mean, like, constrained them to go forward by the strength of her will. She is certainly a larger-than-life figure in her stature, mm-hmm. and in her power, and even in, you know, her leadership and how much they love her. She is not just like a regular person, but I certainly agree with her fallibility. She is not idealized, and certainly she's not idealized in, you know, a woman on a pedestal kind of way, certainly.
Did you see what Mike typed in the chat room? He said, they don't put her on a pedestal, they put her in a mound.
Right. Yeah, that's right. She gets a hero mound, you know, that's with a name, several names.
So exactly. I think those are fair points. That she's obviously not a... Well, it's really hard to know what's going on. Like, it's hard to interpret. She wanted to lead her people westward, and even though most of them were against this council, she took them forth. I mean, does that mean she forced them to go, or does that mean that they were sort of not convinced but said, but hey, you're our leader, so we'll go with you? Like, and maybe... You know, maybe she's not demonstrating the best of judgment, and certainly the passage through what the heck is it called, the really awful place, the land sort of between the mountains of Terror and the Girdle of Melian, it's like, you know, obviously maybe should have at least picked a better path, But I still, like, on the whole, I don't think her... So maybe she is she's a more interesting and maybe a slightly more... I was about to say less two-dimensional than, say, Arwen or Galadriel, which is just an awful thing to say and liable to get me, you know, pilloried. But maybe she's a little more flawed than some of those characters are, at least the way they're portrayed in The Lord of the Rings. And we have to be careful because that's the Hobbit perception of her, and here we get the Elven perception of Haleth. But so maybe she's a little more flawed, but I don't find this to be a particular, like, I don't know. When I read this, I don't sit there and think, you know, man, Haleth, what the heck are you thinking? What a horrible decision. I sort of read it and I think, well, that's unfortunate and maybe not the best choice, but she still seems like a really awesome leader and hero and whatnot.
I agree, you know, and you think about when I was talking about her earlier and kind of wanting to put her not exactly on the opposite pole from Hodor, but certainly very different in that what she does independently. I mean, they are all about... they are all about, that is, the people of Haleth are all about keeping to themselves. I mean, the first thing we're told about them is they don't even have initially any centralized leadership, and they all live in independent homesteads. And, you know, this is, you know, they as a people are the only ones of the three major groups of people. They're the only ones who keep themselves independent of Elvish rule. Now, like, they are sort of theoretically under Thingol because they're living in a part of the forest which is technically part of Doriath, but they are not vassals, really, to anybody. And so, therefore, I was putting her on the opposite pole from Hodor and suggesting, therefore, since I was suggesting that Hodor's position was a good one, that hers is bad. And it is certainly proud. She certainly does have pride in the sense, you know, in I think a not good sense, in that generally that keeping oneself to oneself usually is not a good thing. I mean, if you think about it, they're like the mirror image of Eol over there. I mean, they're like the forest on the other side of Doriath from Eol. And we were looking last time at, you know, Eol moving off on his own and wanting to be independent and set up his own little kingdom. It's not the same. It's not the same. But again, that isolationist tendency.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what struck me, too, is that she seems to be, you know... She rejects Caranthir's offer of protection, and, you know, you might think that's not such a bad thing to do, but she doesn't seek to ally herself with any of the elves or pretty much anyone else. So that, you know, she's leading her people into isolation, and I just can't think that that's a good thing.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I agree with Dave. I certainly don't think that the balance of what we get on Haleth here is like a cautionary tale against. But certainly there are some questionable elements. Mike, go ahead.
Well, can we also add to the discussion on Haleth that, for my money, she has the most traumatic backstory of any character I've encountered in Tolkien. Am I missing somebody? But I was just rereading, you know, her origins, and it's really gruesome.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, and there will be some. You know, we'll read plenty of people's stories later on who are pretty bad. But no, I agree. I mean, she starts with the, you know, the slaughter of her people and the death of her father and brother and her being left alone. Now, this is not the story of like some like poor innocent impressionable girl whose family is slaughtered and becomes this, you know, hugely powerful Amazonian warrior with a will of iron as a consequence, but because we're told that she was already like that before the orcs attacked. But still, I agree. I think that there's she is in part. It is, I think, important not to forget that she is in part a product of her circumstances. Remember, I mean, of course, the other thing with her that we haven't mentioned, you know, Caranthir does come in and rescue her people at the end, and admires them and is willing to give them lands and things, and she won't take it. She is given the opportunity, sort of. She's offered to be made his vassal. And unlike Beor, who is, you know, going and seeking out, can I please, please, please leave my people and come back with you and be your personal vassal for the rest of my life, my surprisingly short to you life, she is the opposite. She won't take it when it's offered to her. Now, you know, it's current there. But still, this is pretty different. But no, I agree. I think that we should remember the traumaticness of her background. Dave?
Well, I would just add, too, that the grass is always greener, of course, and we look and see that, like, you know, oh, she got all her people killed and took them through the suffering of going through the mountains of terror and yada, yada, yada. But we have no idea what would have happened had she stayed. You know, could be that if she had stayed and become Carinthir's vassal, that down the road she would have been involved in all the horrible things, or not she, but her people would have ended up involved in all the horrible things that he and his buddies get up to, or even, you know, who knows what would have happened to them during the Battle of Sudden Flame, when, you know, basically everybody gets routed and screwed over. So it could be that in the long run, what she did was really the best for her progeny.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly the people of Hyleth as a people do seem, they're going to make it longer than anybody else. They're going to be, after the Nir-Naeth Arnoidead, they're going to be the only people who are still hanging out and living together as a people. There are still going to be some isolated groups and individuals and families of the other kindreds. But down there in Brethel, you're still going to get, you know, bunches of the people of Hyleth hanging around. So no, I mean, I agree that there are, it's certainly not obvious that the move to the West has clearly negative consequences. That's certainly true. We should go soon, but I wanted to comment. Jason, without a microphone, is making lots of great comments tonight, which I would love to give him a chance to say. But I want to talk about the skepticism of the resistance to going into Beleriand and staying there. That is the arguments raised by Amlach and Beric. So let's see, any of you want to comment? I know, again, I wish Jason had speaking capabilities tonight, but anybody want to comment on that or represent some of the things that that Jason's been saying about that? Sure, go ahead, Dave.
Sorry, I keep chiming in here, but I did read Jason's points pretty closely, so I feel like I can do him justice. What he was very interested in was the reaction to what the heck is the name of the guy who had the doppelganger?
Amlach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jason was very interested in not what the person portraying Amlach says, because of course we know that was probably a spy of Morgoth, but the reception. In other words, the fact that people were willing to, the fact that people didn't dismiss him outright and say, oh, that's hogwash, you know, shut up. But the fact that he was received by at least some people means that there must have been some seed of doubt in people's hearts or minds. And so Jason was very interested in that, the fact that people were willing to listen to a guy getting up there and saying, oh, there's no shore, this is all made up, it's just the Noldor. And I don't know what else Jason thought about that beyond his general interest in that. Maybe, you know, what's sort of the... Oh, wait, he's typing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk a little bit while Jason's typing here. It is interesting. I mean, you've got these... If you look at how the arguments go, I think that this whole progression is pretty interesting, because the elf friends have the first word, and they say that the leaders of discontent speak first and saying, hey, okay, look, turns out we've gone the wrong way. Here we are, and we were hoping for peace, and now instead we found that we've just come to, like, the very front lines of the war. In the north dwells the Dark Lord, and there is the pain and death from which we fled. We will not go that way. You know, and what they say seems, on pragmatic terms, pretty simple. We were fleeing from fear and terror, hoping to find peace. We believed that it was in the West. Turns out we're wrong. Out here in the West, this is where he lives. We're getting closer to him, not further away. So how about we turn around and go back away? And obviously that's the right thing to do. And the counter argument to that is sort of more noble, but recognizes the same sort of points of view, right? It's like, well, no, so let's, okay, true. The thing we were running away from, it turns out we've been running straight towards it. But you know, that's probably a good thing. And unless he be vanquished here, or at least held in leaguer, you know, then whither shall we turn that he will not pursue us? So we might as well stay here and help. But it's not just like, hey, wouldn't that be pragmatic? The elf friends are also pointing to a higher guiding power. Only by the Valar of the Eldar is he restrained, and maybe it was for this purpose, to aid them at need, that we were brought into this land. So they're talking like, there's this higher purpose for our, you know, it's not at all that our quest was totally misguided from the beginning, and it just turns out that, like, here we are with egg on our face, you know, we're trying to get to peace, and it turns out we've been going in the wrong direction. Don't you feel stupid? I feel stupid. You know, they're saying, no, that's not the case. Yes, it does turn out that we've been going towards danger instead of away from it, but maybe that's how it was supposed to be. Maybe there is a higher purpose. And the only response that Bereg, who is the spokesperson for the resistance, the only thing he says is, "Let the Eldar look to it. Our lives are short enough." Right? I mean, okay, you know, so, like, let's let the immortal people bother about this, and let's try to, because really, we don't need to escape from peace permanently. Let's just scrape, if I can scrape out, like, another 20 years of peace or so, that's good. You know, then I'm going to die and whatever. So fine. But then the shift when the Amlach doppelganger stands up and makes his speech, he goes in a totally different direction. Let's call everything into question. There is no light in the West. There are no Valar. There is no Dark Lord. You know, all of this is lies. And all of these things, the Eldar have just been deceiving all of you, and all of this trouble comes from the Eldar. And that's pretty. It's just a completely different shift. And again, their response: "Then those that listened sat for a while astounded, and a shadow of fear fell on their hearts, and they resolved to depart far from the lands of the Eldar." Anyway, sorry, I've been going on for a long time, but I think that the direction of that argument is really interesting, and then the sudden shift away, and how radical that shift is, to say, no, let's it's not a question of is it our purpose to come here or not, but there is no purpose, there is no enemy, there are no gods, there is no Amon, all of it is made up.
You can't help but wonder if Morgoth didn't maybe overplay his hand there.
yeah, maybe, well, especially.
Not
especially
gone right
since
for
he
that.
Didn't even...
Oh, there's no God. You know, everything you believe is completely wrong. Maybe that was a little too radical. He should have gone for a little. Shouldn't have gone for broke.
Right, or at least have the sense to just off Amlach beforehand, so that he couldn't come in afterwards and give it all away.
So right. I didn't say that.
Right.
I was going to say, though, he does sow the seeds of doubt.
Yeah.
You know, he does put that in people's minds. That, you know, even if you know, it turns out that that person was a spy or whatever, it still puts doubt in people's minds.
Yeah, and I like I love the response after that. You know, this at least you will believe, that there is a Dark Lord in the North. We now have some pretty clear proof that there is in fact an enemy, and his spies are among us. But as you say, Laura, it still works, even after it has been, it seems pretty well proven that this speech was made by a spy who is masquerading as Amlach, yet still they still believe at least some of it. And there's, that is the seeds of their suspicion of the Eldar, is still clearly there. And so even if they're not, even if they're falling short of believing everything that the messenger was saying, that is, that all of it is completely made up, this doubt about can we really trust the Eldar does seem to stick.
And ultimately, that's his main objective. He says that they say that from the very moment that he went out there, his objective was to drive a wedge between the elves and the men. And so Laura's right that he really plants seeds that don't go away. And even once there's proof, there's proof that there's a bad guy, that then what people are left with is that's all there is. There's still no light across the sea and no good people watching out for us. It's even worse now. There's just some bad guys out to get us. And these elves who are quarreling with them, and who knows whether they're really any better than he is. So I think he does his damage. In fact, the fact that that Amlok does come back and says, "Hey, I didn't say any of that. I think that was a spy." That just confuses things even more and unsettles people even more and leaves them probably. I think the ultimate objective is to get a lot of those men to say, "I don't want anything to do with any more of this. Let's get out of here."
Right.
Jason asks an interesting question: Is their doubt reasonable? Is it reasonable for them to doubt that there is an Aman across the sea and that there are Valar? Because we, of course, know that there is, and the elves know that there is, but these men have no direct proof. They've never been over there. Is their doubt reasonable? I'd be inclined to say yes, it's reasonable.
Right.
But
does
Tolkien have a viewpoint on this?
Well, I agree, but I think the interesting thing, I would sort of come at that from the other direction. The interesting thing is not their doubt, but their lack of doubt, rather their belief in the first place. That is, that they seem to have come into this with a general sense of, hey, there's light in the west. And whether it's just, hey, we're following the sun, this is the direction the sun goes every day, so we're just going to, follow it along. But anyway, they believe that there is light in the west, even though they don't really know about it. Did they learn this from the dark elves? Maybe they did, because the dark elves also might have heard rumors of, they might remember some of them. The stories of the light in the west and the trees that the ambassadors, one of whom was, that Thingol was one of the ambassadors. They came back and told them about the trees and the light in the west. So even the Avari who didn't go still know about it. So it's possible that they've heard something about it, but I'm not even sure. It just sort of seems that they're drawn. They don't really know. They're drawn towards the west. So is it reasonable to doubt that? Yeah. But again, I think it's fascinating that they even have a premise to doubt in the first place. I do think, notice at the end, as Laura says here in the text, that, because of the decision of the Valar to sort of distance themselves, they let Morgoth be the only Valar that the men see. And that's exactly where they end up at the end of that conversation, right? Okay, guys, well, one thing we can all agree on now, right? There definitely is a Dark Lord. Whatever else you might think about the light in the west, there definitely is a Dark Lord. We all agree on that. And this, I think, is a really important point. To quote out of context the Numenoreans from later on, the men are indeed going to be operating for the rest of the first stage on a hope without assurance. They will not have seen. All they have to go on is like the reflected light in the Eldar's faces, that is, at least the Noldor's faces. They don't have any evidence other than what they have seen in the Eldar for what actually goes on in the West. And I think that that's... it is reasonable to doubt that, but the best of the men don't. And I think that, when we can see, again, certainly in the House of Hador, the crucial, this willingness to believe, this willingness to join together with the elves, which seems to be a good thing. And yes, Matt, yes, it's true. You've got the yada, yada, yada again. So certainly, yes, if they knew the whole story, maybe they wouldn't trust the Noldor as much. There's a lot not to trust there. But it's Finrod we're talking about. Everybody loves Finrod. Certainly, he is wise. He is good. He is beloved. See, any Mike, you brought up Melian and Galadriel, which I think is I love that conversation, and especially since that one is very directly sort of foreshadowing and foreboding events which are soon to come. We might as well end there. Would you like to? Is there anything, Mike, that you wanted to comment on in particular about Melian and Galadriel's conversation?
From the last chapter and this chapter, it seems like there's kind of a teacher-student relationship to me between Melian and Galadriel. In the last chapter, Melian is looking keenly into Galadriel's eyes to try to discern what's going on in her mind. And in Lord of the Rings, Galadriel now has, you know, she has that skill set now. She does that with the entire fellowship to try to figure out what they're up to. And in this chapter, Melian takes Galadriel aside and has this line where she says, you know, now, what's the phrase that was so great? Now the world runs on swiftly to great tidings. And that reminded me an awful lot of the quote that Galadriel has to Frodo in Lord of the Rings, where she says, in the morning you must depart, for now we have chosen, and the tides of fate are flowing. And so I just saw that between the last chapter and this chapter, there's like these talents and abilities that Melian has that are sort of presented to Galadriel, and I see them as talents that then Galadriel then has in the Lord of the Rings. And the last one I saw was, it was interesting that Melian takes Galadriel aside, not Thingol, to let her know that now things are really going to start happening. In the same way that in Lord of the Rings, Galadriel takes Frodo aside and says, now things are really going to start happening. And her comment to Celeborn is sort of this very stilted toast, something like, you know, night must follow noon, don't be sorry, Celeborn. But what she really sort of delivers the real message to Frodo. So that was my comment.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that Melian, I mean, as you say, it's very teacher-pupil there. But of course, like, the subtext to it is really funny. I mean, her husband has just said this boneheaded and incorrect thing. Into Doriath shall no man come while my realm lasts, not even those of the House of Beor who serve Finrod the Beloved. Not only is this, of course, it turns out, a vastly incorrect thing to say, a very importantly inaccurate prediction that Thingol is making, as Melian is about to point out, but it's also a spiteful and unkind thing to say, like, you know, what would Finrod do, man? That's just not a good attitude. And Melian doesn't rebuke him, doesn't correct him, doesn't say, actually, I beg to differ. Instead, she turns to Galadriel and is like, now watch my husband make a complete mess out of things. And yet I don't say anything to reprove him. Now the world runs on swiftly to great tidings, and one of men, even of Beor's house, shall indeed come, and the girdle of Melian shall not restrain him, for doom greater than my power shall send him. One of the really cool things about Galadriel, we don't get much from Galadriel in the Silmarillion at all, other than that one nugget that we got way back at the beginning when the Noldor rebelled, and about her desire to rule a realm and the way in which Feanor's arrogant speech really resonated with her. Other than that, we don't get too much from Galadriel, but what we do see is like her apprenticeship under Melian. And this does seem to be the first moment where we get this kind of a divide between Melian and Thingol, and this clear gap between what she can see and what he can see. And Mike, you're totally right. We can see the same thing with Celeborn and Galadriel. It happens a couple times, you know, when Celeborn loses it and gets angry at Gimli, when, you know, he finds that the Balrog has been stirred up again, and, you know, Galadriel very gently, you know, rebukes him and he apologizes.
Does Galadriel have an apprentice in Lord of the Rings?
Well, I thought that, you know, your parallel with Frodo is kind of interesting. I mean, we don't see, well, Arwen, right? I mean, Arwen is her granddaughter and is living with her. And of course, she's going to be the parallel, right? She's going to be she's the second coming of Lúthien, right? So she is going to be the one who is in the same, just as Melian, you know, Melian to Thingol is as Galadriel to Celeborn is as Arwen to Aragorn. Kind of works. All three of them are marrying down. All three of them are, you know, queens of a kingdom. So yeah, and Arwen is there under her tutelage. Now we don't see them ever together. So we don't get these sort of delightful asides of, you know, we don't see moments like this with Galadriel turning to Arwen and saying, now let me show you how one manages a froward husband, you know, but certainly we do get a little bit of that. So I think that is interesting. Yeah, but I don't know. It's hard to do much with it because we never see them interacting. Though again, it's under Galadriel's watch. As I mentioned before, it's under Galadriel's watch, not under Elrond's watch, that the real engagement between Arwen and Aragorn happens. So maybe we can in some sense see that in the appendix as you know, sort of an effect of Galadriel's action or intervention here. Laura suggesting Gimli as Galadriel's protege. I love that. Now that's my new answer. Forget about Arwen. Gimli. Yeah. Gimli. Melian to Galadriel to Gimli. Absolutely. That's obviously the answer. Okay. Good. I think with that we should call it a night. Thanks everybody again for a lively discussion tonight. Thanks for bearing with us with the technical issues of our new interface here, our unexpectedly new interface. Anyway, that was great. So I think we'll. We start the downward slope next week with the ruin of Beleriand. So excellent. Yes, sorry, Jordan. We will get one of Fingolfin's shining moments next time. So, Dave, you want 2 weeks on every chapter? We can't do 2 weeks on every chapter. We can do it. We can do it. But I will let Jordan read the Fingolfin scene. So that seems only fair. All right. Well, thanks, everybody.
Okay, that's all for tonight's session. Join us next time for Chapter 18, entitled Of the Ruin of Beleriand and the Fall of Fingolfin, where Fingolfin has his most awesome moment. I would also suggest that you check out Middle-earth Network Radio. This is an internet radio station where you'll find a mixture of music and talk for serious fantasy fans. That's on the net at myemiradio.us. To stay informed on future events, press like on the Silmarillionaire's Facebook page, and follow our Twitter account, Silmarillionaire, and that's spelled without the final E. So, see you next time. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.